We're back, and we're gonna hope for the best, but expect the worst, as it's all about Mel, while we're talking about the 12 chairs. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite show, The More You Nerd, where it's a new month, and that means it's a new theme. And boy, howdy, are we talking about everyone's favorite 100-year-old man, Mel Brooks. What can be said about Mel Brooks that hasn't already been said by himself? I don't know, but we're going to do it. My name is Drew, and I am joined by my comedy cohort that can't stop falling down and making weird noises. Miles, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing all right. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty good. I mean, what the listeners may know if they've heard me in my house with my wife for the last however long, many years, is we're big Mel Brooks fans. And my wife is one of the biggest Mel Brooks fans that I believe exists. She's a huge fan, and Mel Brooks movies are pretty constantly going on in our home all the time. And so we made a point a while back, as she had seen all of them before, but we made a point to start going through them, because of course there were ones that you'd watch more than others, you know what I mean? Like, you're gonna watch The Producers more than you watch another one, or you're gonna watch Spaceballs, or you're gonna watch Blazing Saddles, etc., etc., etc. So we started our watching of all of the Mel Brooks movies, with one notable exception that we might see later in the month, with a movie that is kind of, and I believe I called it last week his first movie. It's not his first movie. It's his second movie. The Producers was his first movie. I was just in the moment and flubbed. But we're going to start this conversation with 1970's The 12 Chairs. And this is a very, very interesting film to cover and to talk about, because it's so early in his career that it's tough to say. I mean, obviously he directed it, but it's like, if you watched it and you didn't know, if you didn't look at the credits and just watched it, I wonder if you would think it was a Mel Brooks movie or not. Miles, had you ever even heard of this movie before?
I mean, I had heard the name. I had never seen it. This is definitely one I had not seen before. And we're going to be covering some movies this month, at least one other one that I've not seen before. I think that's the only other one of his that I haven't seen. But I did have some expectations about this, and I was very curious about it, knowing that it's based off a very popular Russian novel. And Russian novel novels, for those of you who are not as steeped in Russian literature, tend to be pretty depressing.
Well, and it's
so
not
why I was like, huh.
Well, and it's not just a Russian novel. It is a specifically Soviet novel, which has even different other baggage associated with it.
I mean, there is that, but and that is very present even in the material that we watched this week.
Yeah.
Because it definitely seems to be about the poison of a materialistic capitalist society that still infects the people that used to be part of it.
But it's also not like it's both about that and not about that, which is very, very interesting.
I mean, I think it's very much about that in several, like for example, what, I mean, we will get into it, but I did find this to be surprising material for Mel Brooks to cover. It's as surprising as it isn't, because this is also the very kind of material you'd expect Mel Brooks to take and make a laugh out of it. I think what's interesting is, because this is based off a very specific novel, and the fact that Mel Brooks was like, yeah, that depressing ending, I ain't doing that.
Well, and what's interesting about this, and it's a side of Mel Brooks that I think a lot of people don't see, is Mel Brooks was way more of an intellectual than people give him credit for.
Oh, I mean, Mel Brooks is largely responsible for David Lynch's career.
Mel Brooks is like hugely responsible for David Lynch's career.
The Elephant Man wouldn't have happened without Mel Brooks. And I don't know if David Lynch's career would have had the same trajectory at all without the Elephant Man.
If you watch the recent and gosh, I can't remember what the name of it. It was a documentary that Judd Apatow did about Mel. David Lynch is interviewed in it because it was made before.
Is that the most recent one that just came out for his birthday? Oh, I don't think I've seen the new one.
Well, no, it didn't come out for his birthday. Well, it came out maybe for his birthday last year. It was.
Oh, but it's not the one that came out this year for the 100th anniversary of Mel Brooks.
I don't know about that.
There was
a
new big documentary that came out this year.
I don't think I've seen that one yet. I'm not sure I knew it existed.
Like the 99-year-old man or something like that. Or
I think that's actually it. Hang on. Well, if it was the 99-year-old man, it would have been last year.
Well, he wasn't 100 yet. Yeah, it came out this year. It's called The 99-Year-Old Man.
I tell you what, Miles, it's August, and I literally forgot. It came out in January. Last year for me. So, yeah, it's that one. It's a really good documentary.
Oh, gosh, that's heavy. It features the final on-screen interviews of David Lynch and Rob Reiner.
Yeah, it's...
That's insane.
It's insane, and it's really, really sad. But at the time, you know, when we saw it, both of them were still with us.
Yes.
Although the movie does.
No.
Had Lynch died already?
Lynch died in January 25.
Well, then, they have interviews with him for this.
Yes, they do. It's one of his last interviews. Yes.
And basically he kind of talks about Mel stepping in, like giving Lynch some distance, but stepping in and giving him advice that Lynch took for making The Elephant Man, which is absolutely wild.
To touch on what you were talking about, I mean, I think for a lot of the great comedians, and especially a lot of the great like comedians who create and not just like are actors, there is an underlying intelligence. And with most of Mel's movies, there is a sense of someone who is exceptionally well-read, who has interacted with the texts in which he is making fun of, or even the ideas, like the History of the World Part One. Like, this is someone who has actively studied the stuff, because at one point in time, like, that stuff really mattered to folks. And I think that makes it so interesting that he chose the Soviet novel for his second film. And I wonder if part of that's almost even a challenge of like, because I read a little bit about behind the scenes on this movie. And what blew my mind is that Mel Brooks was part of a book club with Mario Puzo, Speed Vogel, and Joseph Heller.
Yes. And it was a book club, but it was really what they called a Chinese gourmet society.
Because they met in Chinatown.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they eat Chinese food, but, the person who told him about this book was, Julius Green, who was, I think, the head writer on the Show of Shows that, Mel had been a part of. And he's the one who introduced Mel to the book and said, this is going to be a great movie. This is going to be a great movie. And Mel basically read it and agreed and started the production of it. He goes through all of this stuff, like, because Mel loves to work with people that he's worked with before. And he actually he had a whole cast in mind for all of the characters in the
which
movie.
Which was a pretty good cast,
the two of them just weren't available. And Gene Wilder, yes, Gene Wilder of The Producers and later of, you know, many other Mel Brooks films, turned down the role because Mel wanted him to play Vorobyaninov, who, because it's a Russian name that I have a hard time saying, I affectionately called the old man throughout the entire movie, as opposed to Bender, the young man. But Gene turned him down because he said he was too young for the part. And so they go through this whole story about Anne Bancroft, Mel's wife, introducing him to Frank Langella, who ended up being the role of Bender in the film, the sort of young vagabond rogue character, and he took him to a play that featured Ron Moody, an English actor, who then got cast as a result as Yuri Bononov, which is crazy. What's also crazy is that this, and if you know anything about Mel Brooks movies, this might be surprising. This is the first time that Dom DeLuise and Mel Brooks ever worked together.
And which is crazy because they work together.
And that is a friendship and a working relationship that literally lasted until Dom DeLuise's death.
Yes. Big fan of Dom DeLuise, and like also he was a major part of Don Bluth's filmography, which I have so much respect for because I'm a massive Don Bluth guy. And I think he was perfectly cast in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. So let's go through some of the plot. And we'll talk about some other things because there is there's one other thing that I want to talk about, which I think is also very notable for this film. So the story of this movie, and this is a Soviet film. It is based on a 1928 satirical novel by Ilfin Petrov. I hope I'm, pronouncing that right. Hang on. Sorry, I'm allergic to my own mispronunciations. So it is a story that takes place in what they call the NEP era of the Soviet Union. And the NEP era is the new economic policy, which is effectively starting in the 20s, Lenin and his crew trying to effectively fix after the revolution, fix the economic problems in the country. And I'm not going to go fully into that because I don't understand it. Just know that this is a point where everything is complicated and weird in Russia. And we have an old woman who is effectively on her deathbed, and she feels death coming. And so she calls out to the other woman in the house to go find her son-in-law, go find her son-in-law, go find her son-in-law. And her son-in-law, Vorobyaninov, golly, this is going to be a tough episode, isn't it, Miles?
Just use the actors.
I can't do that. I'm going to call him old man. Basically,
whatever helps.
She calls him to her side and effectively reveals to him, and we get a little backstory, they were former nobles. The two of them were former nobles, and they had this estate. And when the Bolsheviks came in the revolution and took everything and destroyed things, she asked him if he remembered the dining room set. And he's like, dining room set? What? Da, 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 da. Well, she says that she took all of her jewels, her diamond encrusted tiara, all of these very, very expensive things, and sewed them into the lining of one of these 12 chairs that were part of the dining room set, which sets him off on a quest to find these 12 chairs to hopefully get those jewels back and maybe somehow in the early Soviet Union return to some level of wealth and status, which probably wouldn't happen, let's be honest, but that's, kind of the point of the movie right now. At the same time, the Orthodox priest played by Dom DeLuise, Father Fyodor, has visited first, and she does a final confession to the priest and confesses to him the same thing. So now we have sort of a contest between the two of them to try to go and find these chairs. And all along, there's this other character. And I gotta say, I know Frank Langella has had a questionable past recently in the world. I'm not talking about that. We're not going to bring that up. But Frank Langella looking pretty good in this movie.
Frank, yeah, he did in 1970. Absolutely. But he also like has such a strong like Christopher Lee vibe to him.
He plays Ostap Bender, who is a character. He's basically a young rogue. He's going through. He is flirting with a local woman, and you know, then getting caught by her husband and having to talk his way out of it. He's very quick witted. He's a Han Solo kind of character. He's not a good guy, but
right.
He's charming and he's clever. And that sort of comes through. And as he is just sort of going around and literally trying to find a bed for the night, because beds are not apparently in this part of Russia, not a thing you could just find. People are sleeping on the streets. People are sleeping side by side, and he's trying to get a bed in this place, and ends up kind of falling into learning about what's going on from Vorobyaninov and his former servant Tikhon, played by none other than the man of the hour, Mel Brooks himself,
whom I thought was going to have a bigger part in this movie than he did.
Well, Miles, let me just reference this book right here, Mel Brooks's All About Me, as I tell you a little bit about this.
I need to read that.
It's great, and the audiobook is also great because he does his own.
Your wife has told me a million times that I should just get the audiobook because he reads it and gives the right inflections. And I will say, anyone who gets an audio autobiography that's read by the author, 9 times out of 10, it's excellent.
The book is already written in Mel's voice well enough that you can hear it in his voice.
Right.
And then to hear him do the audiobook, it sounds like he's having these little asides that are just done offhand in the moment, but they're all in here. That's the fun part. It's a great book. It's a great audiobook. I'd recommend either. They're fantastic. But I'm going to read you a little passage from Mel Brooks' All About Me.
All right.
I wasn't my first choice for the role of Tikhon, who is Vorobyaninov's loyal and devoted servant. There was a very good British actor from London that I was going to pay a couple hundred of pounds to come to Yugoslavia to play Tikhon, but he got sick, so he couldn't do it. And I thought, what the hell? Like Anne Bancroft, his wife, said, I look like a Russian. My mother was born in Kiev. So I took the part and saved the couple hundred pounds. Once I knew I was playing Tikhon, I made sure that some of his dialogue was really entertaining. Comrade, everybody calls me comrade. Everybody in the new Soviet Union is a comrade. People you don't know, strangers, everybody says comrade. Oh, how I miss Russia.
It's a great line.
I think I was good. I actually got some compliments from Pauline Kael, a well-known critic, for having a wonderful Russian accent. So that was another good bounce for me. It also started me on the road to being an actor in my own films, which I had never thought about before. This movie is why Mel Brooks, and that role in particular, is why Mel Brooks, from this point on, at least has a minor role, if not a major
cameo,
role.
At least in everything.
Yeah. He had, I believe, a vocal cameo in The Producers as part of the song.
Because when Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, that run ended, I saw it like right after they left, which I'm super bummed about in retrospect, but I got to see this way back in the day on Broadway. And there is a character that is clearly supposed to be like the one-liner Mel Brooks. And you can tell they just kind of recorded the line and played it over the PA.
Be a smarty.
Yeah. The guy on stage clearly isn't Mel Brooks, But I still like they kept the soundbite in because at one point it was, and I don't know. I love that there's a little bit of that magic that remains in even a Mel Brooks play. Because having seen that on tour, because I've seen the producers prop the play about 3 or 4 times, they always play that clip of Mel Brooks's audio.
Yeah, it's in the musical movie as well. I actually got to see the producers in the West End of London, and
fun.
Yeah, it was going to be. I'm trying to remember properly, but I believe Richard Dreyfuss was going to be Max Bialystock. I can't.
Ooh.
Well, I might be wrong on that. I might be misremembering. I can't exactly remember without going back and looking at stuff, but he had some kind of conflict or was not working out. And I don't really know the whole story, but he left the production. And since they didn't have anybody to fill in, they got Nathan Lane to do it. So I got to see Nathan Lane.
Incredible.
As Max Bialystock in the West End of London.
That's awesome. Like, I mean, whoever they had on Broadway at the time was certainly very, very good.
Oh, for sure.
And I enjoyed the production. Because, yeah, you don't get on Broadway if you're not good, for the most part. But, you know, obviously I didn't get to see, like, Matthew Broderick. But back to this.
Yeah.
This
Lee Evans, I believe, is who I got to see as Leo Bloom. And he was in there. Something About Mary. He's been in a bunch of things. British actor.
I know who you're talking about.
It was
so
great, too.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about the 12 chairs, outside of the material that's already been laid in front of us by the novel, I think here is where we really see the birth of Mel Brooks as we know him, which is weird because I think this movie is good but not great. I think it's very, very good, but I think it's missing a little bit of that Mel magic. And I think part of that comes from, I actually don't know, and I haven't read the book, so maybe you can enlighten me more, but it feels like, you know, he's a second time filmmaker. Maybe he's, you know, he's adapting material that's certainly different than what we know him for, but there's a lot of his soul in this movie. And I remember reading that, like, his family's, you know, Russian Jewish, and he viewed this film was filmed in Yugoslavia, which he viewed as like a homecoming.
Yeah.
And he said he felt so at home filming here that it really felt like a pilgrimage rather than just a filming set. And a lot of that comes through in how this film is made.
So I think there's a couple of things to it. He talks a lot in the book about how, and I'm sorry to cut you off.
Mm.
He talks a lot in the book about how a lot of the crew, nearly all of the crew working on this movie, did not speak English. So he was relying on at least one guy that claimed he could speak English on the crew to translate for everybody else. There were a couple of incidents where he, you know, as a result, things got very, very weird and very frustrating. And at one point he threw a chair into the Adriatic Sea and the director's chair. And as a result, the crew almost went on strike because it was the people's chair. It was, we're in very new, like, Yugoslavia was still a communist nation. It just wasn't part of the USSR. So, and of course Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore, but,
right.
It was this whole thing about him having to, like, learning about that, having to apologize. And then they all got drunk together on a specific local liqueur.
I mean, that's how you do it.
Yeah. But really what I think, as I'm watching the movie, now this was the second time I've seen this movie and I liked it the first time, but I walked away loving it this time. And I want to talk about some of that stuff.
I could see that happening to me too.
So the movie starts out and it doesn't feel like a Mel Brooks movie because really it's not L. Mel Brooks' story. It's a story that he's trying to tell. And when you have Ron Moody as Vorobyaninov, who he's really good in this role. He's really strong as this character.
He's
someone
actually very good in this role. I think he's kind of the most important part, despite how charming Frank Langella is supposed to be. I don't think this movie works if you don't have him doing what he's doing.
And that's the thing about this film. As we go through, as the two, as Vior Bananana, the old man and Bender go on this journey together that lasts months, and they keep getting involved in these different little moments where they have to infiltrate this theater group because they inherited some of these chairs from a museum after destroying the chairs in the museum, and they keep hitting and not finding the chairs. They go on a journey together, but at the end of the film, if you're talking about like the hero's journey as sort of a concept, because I don't know that anybody in this movie is really a hero.
I was about to say that no one here is a hero.
No, but Bender as a character, for as much as he's a principal character in this film, he doesn't change. He doesn't go through like a metamorphosis that you would expect a protagonist versus a hero to go through.
Correct. Yes.
But Vorob Yananov does.
He does, but it's not a typical hero's journey change.
Sure.
Which is what makes the character so interesting, and I think what makes this film such a good satire.
Well, and I'm going to go ahead and get to the point we're going to go back to the Mel Brooksiness of it that I started this conversation with, but I just want to talk about one moment in the film. So we are pretty late in the movie. The our duo has failed. We are down to the last four chairs, three chairs where they know where they are and one chair that they don't know where it is. And they are trying to get 30 rubles together to trade with this guy who's stealing stuff from the theater troupe to get him to steal the chairs. And Bender has this idea, and he tells Vorob Yananov that he's got to, do you know how to roll your eyes? And Yananov does all this stuff, and he's basically doing all this spastic comedy that we have seen throughout the movie, especially with Dom DeLuise's father character, who is losing his mind literally and figuratively going through his side of the movie. And basically Bender's like, okay, so here's what you do. You start doing this, I'll call out that you need help because you're having an epileptic attack, and we'll get people to give us money to get you medical attention. And Vior Bananov basically is like, begging? I would never beg in a million years, or whatever you said. And this, the change in Bender's character, Franklin Jella's character, that has been so like sly and quick-witted and cool, there's a snap that he's like, you would never beg. I've had to beg my entire life. And he starts screaming parasite at him. Parasite, parasite.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about the Soviet Union, the term parasite meant something then. It was a stigma for anybody that had what they called unearned income. People who lived off the taxes of the land that they owned that people would pay to them. Basically anybody in the nobility. I think it was a rallying cry during the revolution. I don't actually know that. I just know that it was a term that was heavy. And this scene, like, it just works, and it's not a Mel Brooks scene that you would see in Blazing Saddles or The Producers or Robin Hood Men in Tights. It's a scene in this movie, and it landed so strong for me. It's so good.
It is, and I think that's what makes this movie so interesting to me, because a lot of folks will watch this movie and be like, okay, it's the little baby Mel Brooks movie. But I also think you don't get what most people will consider the cemented Mel Brooks film of Blazing Saddles, which comes out next.
Yeah.
You don't get that movie without what he learns from making this film. And I think when you watch this movie from the lens of a Mel Brooks fan or anyone who's like studied Mel Brooks, His fingerprints are all over this movie. This is such a Mel Brooks movie.
And when I started talking before I got sidetracked on like my favorite scene in the movie, it feels like an adaptation. It feels like somebody else's movie until Dom DeLuise shows up. And granted, Dom DeLuise has his own style of comedy, but it's a style of comedy I associate so much with Mel Brooks. Yes.
But also, it's so funny.
It's so funny as he's just like...
when he goes to Siberia and just starts grabbing the dude and kissing his knee and why is this man kissing your knee?
When Father Fyodor gets the first chair and he and Vorobyanov have a fight over it, and you know that Vorobyanov actually leans down and says, "You're not even worth it to spit on," or something like that. Dom DeLuise says, "But you are," and spits in his face. That was a Dom DeLuise improv in the moment. It made the movie
amazing. What makes this movie such a success for me, is that Mel Brooks took a Soviet novel and did not attempt to Americanize it. He takes the point of the novel and delivers it. Despite the fact that he changes the ending, the spirit of the novel remains the same. There is that kind of poking at the bureaucrats, the aristocracy, that still remains. Like, the old man is still a bad guy.
Right. But
we've seen his change from like, oh, I've gone from this like upstanding record keeper in the new society to being a entrepreneurial criminal. And what better way to say, oh, well, this is what the aristocracy was all the time. They're criminals.
Yeah. But there's also this other side of it. And I don't know how much of this was in the original novel or how much of this was in translation, because obviously Mel didn't read the original Russian version. But when they're trying to find where these chairs, because Vorobyanov goes to his old estate that he lived in and finds out that the Bolsheviks took the furniture, back in the revolution. So he goes to the Bureau of Furniture and has to go. And as they're walking through the Bureau of Furniture, there's the Bureau of tables and desks, the Bureau of bureaus and wardrobes, the Bureau of bureau, all of these different bureau doors that are just funny little, and that's the most Mel Brooks gag in the entire thing, is all of the different doors in the Bureau of Furniture Management or whatever it's called, in there. And of course the Bureau of Bureaus is just very funny, and nice wordplay. But yeah, really so much of it is like, As I watched it the first time, that was the thing I think I liked the most, because, oh, it's Mel, there's Mel Brooks, you know, humor, there it is. But as I watched it the second time, it's like, yeah, but there's so much more interesting stuff that he's doing here that is not these gags. And
I find it so fascinating about this movie. I think this movie is so interesting, not because it's just a Mel Brooks movie. It's more interesting to watch this as Mel Brooks becoming Mel Brooks.
Yes.
And what he takes in, I do think this is required viewing for folks. I think this is a fascinating film. Is it his best? No, but it's still one very, very funny. It has phenomenal performances from all three lead actors.
Yes.
And it's also
Dom DeLuise in Siberia is great, and Dom DeLuise in Yalta is so funny. And then when he gets on top of the mountain, it's so good. It's so funny, gang.
Like, there's so many good gags that are part of the novel, but it's also like there are parts that are like accentuated by Brooks. Like, there are certain things, like the bit with the with Dom DeLuise on top of the mountain, where basically He's been chased. He takes this one chair that he thinks is the one that has the jewels in it, climbs up this bit to where the old man and Bender are like, oh, wait, he can't get down. And then he realizes he can't get down. And it ends on this comedic moment, but you could easily see in any other thing, oh, that could be a serious moment. We've left this man to die.
And in the book, like in the movie, that is the last time you see Father Fyodor. He loses his mind at the top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, well, I guess differently, and I guess we should kind of wrap up what happens. And of course, the chair that they know they have lost in the first part of the story, when they're in Moscow, is the chair that has the jewels in it. And they learn this as they return back to Moscow to try to find it. And where they thought there was something before, there was now a whole big entertainment complex with this buffet,
recreation hall.
It was a recreation hall specifically for the people's chess. Transportation workers or something like
right,
that.
But they go into the chess room, which I thought was hilarious.
Well, I there is a in the book, obviously there's different stuff. They do something at a chess club in the book that is unrelated to the chess room here. I think it was probably just a reference that they may as well have included. And they see the chair. There's the final chair. And Vera Bionanov wants to take it then, and Bender stops. I'm like, no, I'm just going to walk over here and unlatch the window. We're going to come back after dark and we'll take all the time we need. And so they do. And when they rip the chair apart, they don't find anything. What? Huh? And as a result, the old man starts destroying things. He starts tearing things apart. He's flipping tables. He's breaking chairs. He's throwing trophies on the ground. There is not a set chess piece in sight anymore. And as all of this ruckus is happening, they're getting caught by you know, the powers that be there. And basically get told, oh, yeah, the guy that found this chair, it was a miracle. There were all these beautiful gems and rubies and diamonds and et cetera in this chair. And that's what paid for all of this. That whole recreation center only existed because of the discovery of these things 4 months ago while they were trekking across the land. And of course, Vera Bionanov has a very hard time with this, but Bender pulls them out. They escape because they're now being chased by the police. And after they finally escape, and it's the next morning, again, this is where this is where the book differs than the movie, because in the book, well, spoiler warning, Bender was already dead by this point because Vera Bionanov had killed him to try to take the jewels for himself. But the two of them are together. They're on the run. And Bender basically looks at him and says, look, I think we need to go our separate ways. It'll be easier to get away because they're looking for us together. Da, 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 da. I can't afford you anymore, which is such a telling phrase.
Mm-hmm.
I can't afford you anymore. And dejected, having lost everything, Vera Bionanov kind of turns around and walks away. And there's this moment as Bender starts to walk away too. He's got this last piece of the chair, this piece of the chair that he's held on to, even though it doesn't mean it. All it means is all it means is the failure that they had. And you just see it fly into the sky. And then you see Vera Bionanov on the ground, his eyes rolling and him doing these jerking motions on the ground. And a crowd gathers around, and Bender kind of turns around and looks and sees what he's doing. And this look appears on his face. Epilepsy. He's having an epileptic incident. Please, we need to get him medical attention. And all of a sudden, money starts getting thrown on the ground. And as you zoom out, we see Voro Biananov in this very similar state to where he was after the parasite moment. Except, to me at least, it looks like he's dancing. It looks like he's...
Mm-hmm. I fully agree with you.
He's finally, like, he finally understands and on some level is content with where he is. And you have this idea that the two of them are now, after all of this, because they've been through months and months of this journey, that now they are finally on the same level. And it works for me, dude. I like this movie a lot.
I think it really works for me. What I love most about this film is the revelation that the jewels that they have been searching for all these months went to fund, build, and stock this recreation hall. The symbol of the aristocracy, the very thing that the Soviets would have been having a revolution against, was taken and made to make into something that was for the people. And I love that sort of stuff is still intact in this version by Mel Brooks. Like that, and that's what I'm talking about. Is like the intelligence of Brooks, he understood the point of the novel, and he understood like what the work was trying to do and still delivered that point. He just pushed back against some of the things because he wanted to make it a comedy, and I think he's very successful in doing so.
And it was a satire. It was a satire,
but some satire is framed a lot more seriously than others.
I think there was a little more, you know, a little more silliness in the book that maybe, you know, we don't see. Obviously, the book's ending. I
think silliness might be a strong word for a Russian lit, but like, I know what you mean.
It's some again, levity. what a Soviet in 1920 whatever would view as satirical and fun versus what literally anybody else would view as satirical and fun might be a bit different.
But I do think that this movie works so well because Brooks understands the source material, despite the fact that he changes it. And every decision that he made, whether it be casting or comedic beats, is what makes this movie such an interesting part of the beginning of his journey as a filmmaker. And what I find personally inspiring, you and I are both 41 years old this year. You are not yet, but...
No, I'm 41 now. I will be 40.
Oh, no, yeah, sorry. We'll be 42 this year.
Yeah.
Math is hard. that's why I don't... How old are you? I don't know. I was born in 84.
99-year-old man, 100-year-old man. Who's counting?
Right. Brooks was 44 when he directed this movie.
Which is absolutely wild.
Like, his second film, he's 44. So, like, for what we would consider in the 20th and 21st century, like, well, late 20th and currently 21st century, as being, oh, you are middle-aged in well into your later years. No, because once upon a time, that was the beginning of your career. Bogey was the same way. Humphrey Bogart, I don't think, got really popular until he was 40. Like, that was... No, sort of the thing. So it's Rodney so Dangerfield, interesting to me.
Rodney Dangerfield wasn't popular until he was like his 50s or something. It was crazy.
Yeah, he didn't get any respect. I mean, that's what happens. Yeah. But yeah, I find this kind of inspiring because, like, you know, he had been in entertainment forever. But for this to be his second film and be as good as it is, because yes, I said this is I personally this is good, not great. But I mean, I'm talking about this is a 7 out of 10 film. This is a very solid movie.
And it would be one of his best if he didn't also go on in a couple of years
to make classic films like Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
Which, by the way, both came out in 1974. He had Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein in theaters in the same year.
Which is insane to me. Because, I think Young Frankenstein is like one of those perfect comedies ever made.
As is Blazing Saddles. They're both absolutely fantastic. As is Blazing Saddles,
but I mean, partially because I'm a big horror guy. But Young Frankenstein is just... it's magic to me. And it's one that I know my fiance deeply loves as well. I don't think he gets to do some of his more overt comedic moments here. Like, he's got some really great comedic moments, but some of the stuff, like a lot of his pun work, is not present here. Like Rolling the Hay, you know, from Young Frankenstein. Yeah. Like, that kind of level is not present here.
The most direct Mel Brooks comedy that I would recognize as Mel Brooks is All Those Doors in the Bureau of Furniture, or when they run by a road sign in Moscow that was Tsar Nicholas II Lane that just has a big X crossed out, and it was Lenin and somebody and Trotsky Lane, and Trotsky was crossed out.
Yeah, that was great.
It's like it's a great visual gag that you have to know.
Is this supposed to be a visual gag, or is it supposed to be giving us an actual depiction of the area? Like when all the old ladies are out sweeping the snow, but like they're kind of just like pressing against it just a little bit with some straw. Like,
yeah,
you know, yeah. But I think this is such a fascinating movie, and it's genuinely funny. Like, this is a good, funny movie with excellent performances by pretty much everyone involved.
I really, 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 really like.
To be honest, I expected this movie to be a mess.
Well, because if you look at its review score, if you look at its average reviews, it's not great.
It's not great, and then the fact that it's not readily available, and the even like when you look it up on Wikipedia in what looks like an old like VHS cover, it makes it look kind of cheap and uninviting, and so you're kind of expecting the worst, despite the fact that, like, you know, he started with The Producers, which is a good movie turned into a great musical. I really wasn't sure what to expect coming in here. And the fact that you get this really smart adaptation of this Soviet novel it's such a Mel Brooks thing to do.
Yes.
Like, to turn something that could have been, you know, this really interesting but somber experience into, frankly, a delightful little movie. That even despite the fact that it has kind of like, oh yes, the hero's journey ends in failure because it needs to. It has to end in failure or this movie doesn't work. And despite the fact that he bucked against the depressing ending, which is that Bender gets murdered by the old man and, you know, nothing good happens, he still gives a variation of that. But it's more of a celebration of the anti-hero's journey.
And say what you will about the overall viewing of this film, because I think it also was, because The Producers was a much more overt comedy than this movie was. You have a lot of reviewers that are going in expecting that and not getting it and rating it more negatively as a result. But
yes.
Of all of the reviews that I read, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel both gave it 4 out of 4 on their individual reviews. I mean,
Ebert gave it 3.
No, Ebert gave it 4 stars out of 4.
Hold on, let me look. I thought I just had that pulled up. Oh no, you're right.
Yeah.
What was I looking at?
I triple checked.
You're right. You were right.
Ebert said, "You do laugh a lot. It's not going for the laughs alone. It has something to say about honor among thieves." And by the end of the film, we can sense a bond between the two main characters that is even amazingly human. And I couldn't put it better, Roger.
Yeah. I have no idea what I was looking at earlier. That was a 3 out of 4 stars. But yes, I agree with a lot of what Ebert says. I don't know if I give it 4 out of 4, but it's a pretty great movie. Yeah, like it's a pretty good movie. Like I've constantly said it's good, not great. And I stand by that. I think it's a fantastic movie. I think it's a great movie to represent the beginning of Brooks's career. And I think it's a very transitional film because I think this is the movie where you see him turn into Mel Brooks, because you see a little bit of those flourishes pop out, and then Blazing Saddles, obviously much more. And then Young Frankenstein, he is fully Mel Brooks.
Yes. And this is where I think this film, and you don't do it now, do it in like 18 months. Watch this movie a second time.
Yeah, I would love to.
And see where your standing lies. Because when I watched this for the first time, you know, a couple years back, I liked it. I didn't love it. And as I watched it this second time, and I was talking to my wife about it, and we talked for 45 minutes about this movie after it was over. Just going back and forth about all of the stuff we noticed this time that we hadn't noticed in previous viewings, and all of this other stuff about this story. And that, yes, this is maybe the least Mel Brooks movies of any of the Mel Brooks movies, but it is, like you said, important to his development as a filmmaker.
Yes, 100%.
We don't get Blazing Saddles without this. We don't get Young Frankenstein without this. We don't get the rest of Mel Brooks' career without this. And that's why I insisted on including this in our list, because
I'm glad we watched this one.
It's just so important, and you don't think it's going to be when you read like what it's about, and you're like, oh, he adapted a Russian novel. It doesn't sound like it's going to be what it is, but it really works, and it shows the brilliance of Mel Brooks in a way that doesn't come out in a lot of his other work that he's directly involved in.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And with that, I think we're ready to push the chairs in and pull out the chair for next week's movie. Because next week we are going to skip ahead a couple of years, but not that many years, to one that he's made he's made parodies of Westerns. He's made parodies of, or made a parody of a Western of Westerns. He's made a parody of horror movies, classic
yeah,
horror movies,
Monsters. Yeah.
Universal Monsters. But now what happens when Mel Brooks makes a parody of the great Alfred Hitchcock? We're going to watch High Anxiety. Miles, have you ever seen this one before?
I actually have not. I'm very excited to see it.
I've seen it once, so I'm really, really looking forward to seeing this one. Because again, this is one that does not have a ton. Like it's also because we're not covering the big names. We're covering the sort of, you know, I don't want to say less than, or the lesser knowns.
The lesser talked about Mel Brooks films.
I think this is, we're moving from 1970 to 1977. So he's got a number of very, I guess he's also done silent movie in between this too,
both of these movies Silent Movie and High Anxiety were big hits. I mean, he made them for about $4 million and they made 30. So, I mean, they made money.
This is in, you know, the peak of Mel Brooks, but it's one of the ones that's not as talked about openly versus the rest.
I'm excited to watch it. One, it has Cloris Leachman, who I absolutely adore, and I am excited to see another film with her in it.
I love Madeline Kahn, so I...
Yeah, Madeline Kahn's great too.
And Harvey Korman again, all people that have been in Mel Brooks's movies before. Man, if I had a time machine and could go back in time to Hollywood, I would want to be in all of Mel Brooks's movies. That'd be very fun.
That sounds like a great time.
So that's going to be next week as we watch High Anxiety, which hopefully it's streaming somewhere, but you know what? It's Mel, so you can find it wherever you can find it. I've got it on disc. It's one of all the movies that you know me and Miles talk about physical media. I got all Mel stuff on physical media, except for one movie. But
wild to me because like I'm the physical movie guy.
So with that said, gang, that's where we're going to call this one. We're going to end the show. If you would like to reach out to us, you can find us in a number of places, including themoreyounerd.com, where you can find this and every other episode. You can find us on social media, either @ themoreyounerd, just about everywhere. And of course you can email us themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. You can also find us at CosmicCrit.com. What's Cosmic Crit, you ask? Well, that's the show where me and Miles and all of our friends play tabletop role-playing games, specifically the game Starfinder by Paizo. It's a ton of fun. It's like D&D in space. Come check us out at CosmicCrit.com. If you go to CosmicCrit.com, which I highly recommend, you can find a link to the Cosmic Crit Discord where you can go and find your own games. CritterCon is coming up where a bunch of different stuff is going on. I'm sure we'll have some live stuff that we haven't even started talking about yet, but don't tell anybody that we said that. But
that's okay, I won't be there.
Yeah, that's right, you're out of town.
Because for whatever reason, CritterCon now happens whenever I'm out of town for my yearly vacation. So
you know, it's okay, Miles. But you can also, if you join the Cosmic Crit Discord, you can just talk to me and Miles all day while we are bored at work. So with that said, we're going to end the show as we always do with a rousing
nerd
out.
Tuner for y'all,
comrade.
To you, John.